Hello everyone, welcome and thank you for coming today. My name is Sarala Estrick and I'm a Ledbury poetry critic and a poet. I'm really looking forward to our reading today with Victoria Adukwebuli and Kayo Chingonyi. And we're also lucky in that we're going to also have a conversation towards the end. So if you have any questions, we should have some time for audience questions. And also thank you to Arts Council England for your generous support of our events. Also thank you and welcome to our audience online from around the world. So I'd now like to introduce our first reader. Victoria Adukwebuli is a poet, writer, and artist based in London. She is the winner of an Eric Gregory Award and has held residencies internationally in the US, Brazil, and the V&A Museum. Her debut poetry collection, Quiet, was released by Faber in the UK this year and is set for North American release in January 2023 with Knopf. She is an alumna of the Barbican Young Poets and Octavia Poetry Collectives, and also a fellow of the Complete Works programme, and is currently a doctoral student at Royal Holloway, University of London, supported by a Techne Award for practice-based research in creative writing. Please join me in welcoming Victoria Adukwebuli.
Thank you everyone for being here. I'm just so happy to be back in Ledbury in this amazing weather. It's so summery. And also I'm honoured to be here with Kayo. I think it's such a milestone when you get to take part in an event with someone who you were watching from a distance earlier in your own sort of trajectory. So I'm just very honoured that I have this opportunity to be here with Sarala and Kayo. So I'm going to read from Quiet, which is newer than, I've had two babies this year, this is the second one. Even though it was finished first, books take longer than babies do to come out, but I'm gonna read from Quiet and we'll see which ones to choose. But I'll start at the start with declaration. Declaration. If sickness begins in the gut, if I live in the belly of the beast, if here at the heart of empire, if careful in the house of the host, if quiet at the hearth of the host, if here at the home of empire, if I live in the belly of the beast, let me beget sickness in its gut. Revision. One, consider. From the 1400s, the area later known as the Gold Coast would be, choose one, discovered, invaded, visited, landed upon by Europeans, illegal aliens, migrant workers, tourists, Christians, hailing from the ports of Sweden, Denmark, England, the Netherlands, Portugal, Prussia. During their visit, residency, occupation, sabbatical, stay, they would alter irreversibly the ecology, lives, speech, gods, memory of the Homo sapiens, natives, people, fauna, inhabiting the land. It is not clear what their expectations were. One could assume they were successful, even after completing, losing, leaving, tiring of the project and going home. It is arguable that they did not actually leave. Two, compare. A, onion, sabolai, hint, cebola. B, chale, Charlie, hint, fam. C, hint, water bird, duck, doko doko. D, lala, hint, lala, song. 3, consolidate. In the year of our Lord, 1471, they came. In the year of our Lord, 2017, I look for my language, still finding in it their hairs. 4, conclude. Oh, Chale, I stayed in Portugal for a year and loved it more than England, fam. Patriot who? Water off a duck's back, two colonizers, one with better weather. What's the problem? The people were happy. It was hot. I stayed in Bunyao. I'd go to the market and buy vegetables and come home to the apartment and make rice and stew. I do that when I want to feel at home. I like to think that I can bring home with me. And you know, I can't speak Ga, but our word for onion is sabolai, right? And the Portuguese word for onion, cebola, cebola. I love it. I love it and I hate it. And this year it happened again. This very January, Mum played me a video of Grandma singing a folk tune. And she told me that the word for song in Ga is lala, lala, as in deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la, can you believe that? And I was so happy to see Grandma so alive singing all these words, of which I understand nothing. See her clapping all nearly 100 and fully bat-blind years of her, even Mum didn't know the story. She just translated the outline to me, which I don't remember now. But the whole time, I could only stand there. I was just watching and thinking, damn, this lala feels sad. This one lala sounds like a sorry song. With his hopscotch grid for a wrist, see my blue boy with a smile like a one-string guitar, relative to nobody, dropping out of school, out of line, saying, I love you more than life itself, in a first Valentine's card during the time in which we turn 15. In the attic of an old phone now, here he is again, in the drawer I was emptying, during a hymn I was singing before I met him, and here he is, my blue boy. Now, watch this older girl stop and throw her day out with the dust and turn blue too. This whole impermanence thing is deceptive. Looks lifelong, actually, to me, still stuck here, molding mason jars of words to preserve him with, wondering if a poem 10 years on is still opining, asking how many more I will make before I learn at last how little of us keeps. not quiet as in quiet, but as in peaceful, as in slow to anger, as in shy, as in sulking or sullen, as in nice, as in clean, tree-lined streets, as in well-resourced libraries, as in good, outstanding schools, as in not much new, as in no news is good news, as in the war is over, has been for decades now, as in early to bed, curled up with a book, as in the newborn is sleeping, as in TV barely audible, as in subtitles, as in subtext, as in someone should have done something, as in don't just do something, stand there, as in could and should but wouldn't, as in well, the British are so polite, as in placid, as in placated, as in nuanced, complicated, as in careful, it's a conflict, not a siege, a conflict, as in objective, as in both sides, as in well-behaved, as in safe, as in too quiet, as in almost silent, as in almost no sirens. So this next poem, called How Not to Disappear, I guess is dedicated to, although it's not, doesn't say that here, but it's dedicated to a boy who went missing last March from his West London home. His name is Richard Okoroge, and the poem begins with a quote from his mother while he was actually still missing. So the quote reads, "I told a police officer that my son was missing. Please help me find him. And she said, if you can't find your son, how do you expect police officers to find your son for you? How not to disappear. Who would guess the prayers you'll say walking home at night, crossing streets you know too well were never yours to claim? All the promises you'll make about what you'll do with your life should you live, should you make it to the warm indoors, the soft and grateful bed. God, you'll say, below your breath, let no strange man put hands on me. Let the dark not drape this body on terms other than its own. Speed me to the front door. Let the first key be the right one, the mechanism oiled and easy. And should I fail, you'll say, in any of this, let me have spoken to no one lately about bad days, hard times, or worse, have written a poem or two about them, to be found when my belongings are searched, finally, too late. Please, God, you'll say, one more time, deliver me home to my known life, seen and loved by those to whom it's always mattered, born and fed by a lover and others who, like you, already know how and how not to disappear, unable to forget the way they spoke to that boy's mother." One thing I'm finding as I'm reading these poems is that, and I know no one's following it like we're in church or something, like we turn to hymn page, there are words that I'm saying that are actually not in the book because I'm reading, I have memorized previous versions of poems or previous drafts. So I think it's funny how the ghosts of earlier versions of poems stay with us. I'm correcting myself as I go, like, it doesn't say that. Let's see, how much longer have I got? Oh, the clock is right there, Victoria.
You've got
about 3 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
4 minutes.
Oh, okay, let's go to the back of the book. Let's read the ultra black fish. The ultra black fish. "200 meters down, the light stops. Many deep sea creatures alive at this level of the ocean have developed the ability to create light for themselves. This is known as bioluminescence. Others, on the contrary, contribute to the darkness by adding themselves to it. Ultra black fish are one example, and in 2020, 16 varieties of these were captured. The level of pigment in their skin was so high that it was found to absorb 99.956% of the light that touched it. Karen, a marine biologist, came across them by accident. Instead of hauling up the deep sea crabs she had been searching for, her net produced a fang-toothed fish that wouldn't show up in a photograph, held later in a tank under two strobe lights. The fish became a living black hole with no discernible features beyond the opacity of its silhouette, as though it had cut itself out of the image and left. Scientists believe that the fish developed their invisibility to aid them in escaping their predators. Another theory suggests that the obscurity of ultra black fish enables them to more successfully catch their prey. It is likely that both ideas are true. Commentators have also speculated that the chemical structure of the pigment could serve the development of military and defense technologies. Nothing was said, however, about how ultra black fish find and enter into relations with each other. Nonetheless, their existence alone is evidence that, invisible as they may be to others, they are by no means strangers to themselves. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that reading, Victoria. It feels like such an honour to have you read those because, as you said, the book is it just came out last month, and so we're very privileged to have Victoria here reading those for us and to hear your voice behind these poems that I've loved on the page.
Thank you
so much. I'd now like to introduce our second reader. So Kayo Chingonyi was born in Zambia in 1987 and moved to the UK at the age of 6. He is the author of 2 pamphlets and a fellow of the Complete Works Programme for Diversity and Quality in British Poetry. His first full-length collection, Kumukanda, won the Dylan Thomas Prize and a Somerset Maugham Award. He is a writer and presenter for the music and culture podcast, Decode, on Spotify, poetry editor at Bloomsbury, and Assistant Professor of Creative Writing at Durham University. His most recent collection, A Blood Condition, was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best Collection, the T.S. Eliot Prize, and the Costa Poetry Award. Please join me in welcoming Kayo Chingonyi.
This being a quasi-liturgical setting, I'll begin with this poem. I have known you by many names, but today you are Larry Levan, your hand on the platter in the smoky room of a garage regular's memory. You're keeping when doves cry in time as you swing your hips and sweat drips from your hair the color of James Brown's scream. King of King Street, We're still moving to the same sound, though some of us don't know it's your grave we dance on. Cutting shapes, machismo lost to the beat. Every roadman is a sweet boy if the DJ plays heartbroken. At just the right time for these jaded feet, teach us to shapeshift, Legba. You must know I'd know your customary shuffle, that phantom limp, anywhere. That I see your hand in the abandon of a couple, middle of the floor sliding quick and slick as a skin fade by the hand of a Puerto Rican clipper man who wields a cutthroat like a paintbrush. Let us become like them, an ode to night, ordering beer in a corporeal language from a barman who replies by sweeping his arms in an arc, Willy Ninja style. To fix a drink our lips will yearn for, a taste we've been trying to recreate ever since. So my necklace is gonna bump a little bit on my microphone, but we're gonna handle it like the urbane and sophisticated people we are. And I'm gonna try not to gesticulate too much, but I can't make any promises, I'm African fam. I'm gonna read a little bit from A Blood Condition. That poem is in Kumukanda. And was my customary beginning for a long time. So it's nice to revisit it here in Ledbury, especially because chances are last time I read in this room, I read that poem first. This is a poem called A Northerly Aspect, which is, yeah, kind of a love poem to the Northeast, a little bit about the South. We'll get into that. A Northerly Aspect. We flew south, and though Wandsworth alleyways banished Hawares from my diction, still my heart has a northerly aspect, quite apart from this voice that divides opinion when I carry it far from home. How to gesture towards tall ships, Grace Darling, bottles of pop, Bobby Shafto, the part of me lost to the realm of ledgers, of legend, the part that ascribes to darkness light, here where the landscape is a long conversation, and the breeze, a list of the missing and of the dead, read from the surface of these stones that do not forget. Writing this poem, and indeed this poem, I was thinking a lot about language and I suppose the textures of it. That's something I'm particularly interested in. And there is, in the place I live now, in West Yorkshire, a very particular resonance and texture that this word has, which forms the title for this next poem. In that neck of the woods, the word is ginnel. But you will also hear it as genel, and also ginnel, and you can get into long arguments about which is correct. And if you move a little bit west, then the word is replaced by the word snicket. But if you don't know, a ginnel is what we might call an alleyway, but it's a gap between two otherwise terraced buildings, a thoroughfare. Ginnel. An interstice, a quarter tone. Last known whereabouts of missing persons the world over from the old English, the coast's open moor pointing the way to the Whale Road. Gap in the teeth of a terraced street. I'm gonna read this poem. Because it strikes me that Ledbury is a town full of artists in one way or another, visual, sculptural, verbal artists. And I love to be in such places. And this is called Landscape with Motorway, which is, it's written from and through a piece of ceramic art which depicts a motorway, basically. And I was struck in looking at this piece by the kind of by my constant interest in urban spaces, particularly those that are layered upon each other. Landscape with motorway. Tessellated lives, unfolding as a flurry of words unfolds in an underpass, cipher and ciphers scrawled on brickwork. The wind spits the sickest bars both about and through this landscape. No less worthy of our gaze for being made as a ceramic receptacle for meaning is made, and a link between concepts. And all that is the case, and Wittgenstein's thesis and our means of apprehending it crafted by some hand. Here the spot a car abandoned its original trajectory. Here a squabble turned final. Here a wayside shrine, a warning sign. A monument unmarked for all but those who hold this place suspended in the mind, who walk in the ruins of a bygone ends that exists in the tense of potential, but nonetheless exists. I want to read this poem and then a slightly longer one, and then perhaps I'll return to the first book so it doesn't get lonely. This is called Heirlooms. The stein with a chipped edge. You're sure you bought for a quid in Camden. Belonged, if you ask me, as well you might, to my mother. Known all her life by a name she detested. What does it mean to answer to a misnomer? To feel the cold air between being and being seen. We have filled our house with her things. Alfred Meakin dinner set, cutlery etched with the indicia of the Newcastle Corporation made in Sheffield by Firth Steelworks, a white drop leaf, crystalline glassware, a house proud woman's cash. I live in an artist's impression of the flat in Wandsworth. I cut vegetables with the knife my mother reached for in rage. I remember the sound of metal scraping wood, the door I had just grown strong enough to hold closed. So this is a poem, this next poem interacts with the history of Black British music, and most especially a corner of it called grime, which you should explore in your own time, preferably in headphones or a very loud, bass-heavy sound system, if you can find one. But it's also an elegy to two MCs who are kind of formative to my experience of lyricism and words. One a very famous one famous to us in our local area. So this is Blues for Albert Prodigy Johnson and Carl Hasty Samuel. Another scribe of black trauma has passed from this life into the spirit world or nothingness, depending on how much store you set by Nietzsche. Apt that the arch laureate of nihilism comes to mind when I think of Prodigy, old before his time as I was old before mine. We passed a zoot, rolled with torcador finesse, round a circle in barking before it had a health spa. One of our number was confined these times to his room by shame, a death of some kind because lying under a sky pockmarked with stars, he asked his girlfriend why she was so quiet. When Hasty walked or fell in front of the lorry, did he pass away if I can still hear him going back to back with Kester and raps? If I think of him standing shoulder to shoulder with Prodigy in a circle of dead MCs, screwing up his face, singing, "Listen up, I'm so raw. You know I'm MC Hasty and I'm on tour. When I spit my lyrics, them a shout more. When I give you more, the people them will be so sore." In the year of our Lord 2003, Tox was still passing himself off as Little Dizzy, though Tox was by then closer in height to Jamaccabee. After Lord of the Mics dropped, the gas was such, it just took a younger bus in a half-decent beatbox for the clash to start. Everyone played their part, from the hype men spitting lines back like a space echo to those standing just outside the cipher, but close enough to cuss the vanquished when a space opened for them to walk in the unforgiving light of mediocrity. This was before anyone in our circle had been stabbed or shifted. Some had shouldered a wooden box, but none of us understood the cost of the shanks and skengs in our lyrics. If we knew these days as halcyon, is hard to say. The mind is some next ends. We wouldn't have been caught dead, slipping, convinced as we were that the patch of grass beside the golden fish was big enough to constitute a world. I drink some water and finish with a couple of short ones. So, I recorded this to camera so you can watch it back again afterwards if you want to, in the archive of Ledbury Recorded Poets that's been happening. And thank you to Sam for that. I'm thinking I'm remembering your name correctly, I hope so. So this is called Fisherman's Song. And it's kind of like a sea shanty, and I'm sad that I wrote it when I wrote it, because sea shanties have had a real, like, resurgence. But anyway. What sadness for a fisherman who navigates the blue to find among receding nets strange underwater blooms that look at first like bladderwrack, but from a closer view are clumps of matted human hair atop an acrid soup. And what song shall this fisherman who loves a jaunty tune sing to lullaby his children when dark shapes in their room make the night a snarling monster only father's voice can soothe? And who will soothe the fisherman who navigates the blue? I'll finish with the title poem of the first book. Since we talked about the loneliness of the poems in that book, I want to honor them briefly. So the book is called Kumukanda, which is a Luwali word for initiation. It's the name given to the initiation rites, which any self-respecting Luwali boy passes through. And the poem goes like this. Since I haven't danced among my fellow initiates, following a looped procession from woods at the edge of a village, Tata's people would think me unfinished, a child who never sloughed off the childish estate to cross the river boys of our tribe must cross in order to die and come back grown. I was raised in a strange land by small increments. When I bathed my mother the days she was too weak, when my aunt broke the news and I dressed my mother's body in a yellow suit and white shoes, at the graveside, when the man I almost grew to call Dad, though we both needed a hug, shook my hand. If my alternate self, who never left, could see me, what would he make of these literary pretensions, this need to speak with a tongue that isn't mine? Would he be strange to me as I to him, frowning as he greets me in the language of my father? And my father's father, and my father's father's father. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kayo, for that incredible reading. And I'm so glad you finished on that poem. That Kumukanda is actually one of my favourite poems of all time. That's such a powerful poem. All of them were. So now we have time for a sort of brief discussion between ourselves. I'll ask one question, and then I'll open out to you all if you have any questions to ask the poets. So Kayo and Victoria, I feel like there are loads of rich overlapping threads and motifs in your work. Most of all, I love how you both grapple with history, legacies of the past, and our present moment, our attempts to grapple with those legacies. And you do this on a personal level and also on a national and even a global scale. Could you speak about the role history and legacies of the past play in your work? I don't know who would like to go first.
Do you feel able to say something about it?
I think that history is like a foundation always for anything I write, even if it's not necessarily about history, because there's that sense of, you know, even if you look at soil, for example, or if you do a dig, or, you know, I remember being young and actually, I forget that at some point as a child, I wanted to be an archaeologist because I thought it was so fascinating that you could just, rather than sort of going in any sort of direction, like left, right, west, north, whatever, going down is going into the past. And the things that you find there are literally layered, like you can read the soil or you can read rock. And so I think with writing, there's always something underneath the words, and even in the etymology of words, I think is something I find quite fascinating. And moving one word from English into another, going to a Latin root or going to, a different version in, say, Portuguese or something, I find it explodes language and actually shows the trajectory of history within language, for example. So in one of the poems that I read, I'm really thinking about the different words we could use for an event such as colonialism or an experience, and how those words kind of contain different viewpoints, so to speak. So I think that's a long way of saying that history is really important for me, and the looking at the layers, the looking at the strata is something that I find quite fascinating, because we aren't really encouraged to do that in our daily lives. We kind of are encouraged to be forward, 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 always, progress, always, in a way that I don't think is very healthy and is not very grounded. So.
Yeah, thank you. I love that idea of going down for knowledge instead of, you know, left, right, just going downwards for knowledge. And also that correlation between archaeology and poetry, I think, and how you're doing that with words. Yeah, thank you so much for that. Kayo, could you speak a bit about that as well?
Yeah, I'm really moved by everything that you just said. And to get that kind of, I really see that resonance in your work with the setting of historical context or setting of words in their historical context. And I'm really moved by that enterprise, I guess, because to set something in context is to add layers of texture. And I love that word you used, layers, to describe history. Because I feel like language and poetry are kind of ancient technologies that we still use. And I think the reason we do is that they are particularly good at capturing a moment, capturing history. And every time you write something, you're, whether you know it or not, participating in a historical project because of the baggage or association that the word has, whether you know it or not. I really love that about words being the material we use. I think it's always interacting with history to write. And in particular, interacting with the history, especially in the West, which has been hostile towards our being in the world, let alone cultural production. So I feel like, thinking about that when I write is a really important part of the work for me. and probably always will be.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I absolutely see that that's so true about, you know, just the act of writing is engaging with history through language, through the material of writing. Absolutely. Thank you so much. Do we have any questions from the audience, either at home or here? Yes. Thank you. Please wait for the roving mic.
Yeah, thank you. Is that working?
Yes.
Thank you both very much for a fabulous reading. I mean, one thing that particularly struck me about Victoria's work is the use of, inverted commas, academic language. Language which pretends to be objective, but in fact, of course, is hugely value-laden. And it seems to me that you take that and subvert it. And at the same time, you're obviously at the moment personally working in an academic setting. I don't really have a question, but I'd be just really interested to hear how you mediate that and how conscious that kind of subversion that we see, you know, like in the Ultra Black Fish, is. Is there anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because I do think that, and this is why I like having work out now, because I grow from comments like that. It helps me to see something that I've done without thinking too hard about it. But I think something that really fascinates me is how language performs, and, you know, acts of language, and how words can be a kind of costume. And I am a writer, I'm not a maximalist writer in that I don't like to oversay. And that's also because I think my own attention span is always, it's primed for the essentials and not everything all at once. It's just primed for essences. And I have found, you know, even reading academically, for example, reading someone who, Fred Moten, I have had experiences, and this is someone whose work I love, but I found that sometimes I'll have to spend so long reading just three pages because Moten loves to language. Like, I have to respect that he's doing something that he's enjoying when I'm like, what are you talking about? And what he's talking about is incredible, but it's so intense. And so, but you know, he's the wrong example to use here, but I think in the book, I really like, in a way, mocking other kind of institutional uses of language and category, and how language, and I think I have heard, and I think I see it, how the English language is a language of categories. It's quite an Anglo-Saxon thing to categorize in ways that in other languages I've heard are not, it doesn't happen so easily. So I've enjoyed sort of using the register of certain language acts and sort of poking fun at them, which I think is kind of what I was trying to do in that poem. And to sort of say, in that poking fun, to sort of suggest that you are performing knowledge and I can see you performing knowledge, but you don't fool me, sort of thing.
Brilliant. Thank you. Do we have any? We have time for a final one, I think, or maybe two, if they're quick.
This is a question for Kayo. Once when I was in Ireland, and that might be significant to this anecdote, somebody said to me, so if you think you're a poet, could you give us a poem, please? And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't know any off by heart. They said, well, you're not a poet then, was the answer, and that was, you know, the end of that story. But I was just wondering, because you've given us a wonderful read. It wasn't, in a sense, not a reading. It was gave us your poetry off by heart in the Irish way, and how that comes about. Whether you, what the sort of technique is for you of coming to be able to speak your poems without reading them, whether you actually learn them off by heart, or is it while you're writing them that they somehow remain with you and you're able to remember them?
Thank you. I guess Yeah, through process is one of the main ways that they find their way into my memory, but it's not any longer like a conscious process of rehearsal and stuff like that, though it should be, honestly. Like, my tutors in drama and voice would be unhappy with my current laissez-faire attitude towards rehearsal. But after a while, they just, I guess, stick, and I have the kind of memory for which that is the case, especially things that I hear. My auditory memory is particularly attuned. And the problem, actually, that I find is I quite often forget what the title of the poem is. And if I can't remember the title, then I can't remember the poem in an odd sort of way. Equally, if I somehow say like the wrong word and I like go to an earlier version, as you were talking about, like there's like something happens inside my body whereby like that registers. It's interesting. But yeah, it seems to me it's an important part of poetry that it's portable in that way. And I don't know that you need to take a whole poem into your head, but you can take a phrase, a line, and I think that, yeah, that's very special. I think it's very unique in that way, that you can carry it around. Mm. It can accompany you when you're waiting for a bus, and otherwise, a loose end.
Brilliant. Can you assure us, though, that if you haven't memorized your poems, or if you can't perform your poems, you are still a poet? I don't know. This person would.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be so bold as to make such a pronouncement. Yeah, I feel like there's something about writing that consolidates a thought, which is equally, to my mind, important. Mm. So yeah, it's the two. It's the two in tandem. The technologies feed each other.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I want to get one more question, if there is one. Yeah.
Ultra black fish is such a perfect image. Are they real, or have you made them up?
Said ultra black fish is such an incredible image. Are they real, or have you made them up?
No, they're real. No, honestly, the biologist's name is actually Karen.
Oh, really?
Yes, guys, this is a real person. And I mean, I sort of feel like I should email her and say, look, I'm not dissing you. Yeah, no, they're real. And I can't remember how I stumbled upon them, because obviously it's very recent news that they were discovered, but I was thinking about pigment and blackness, and I think I must have been searching online for what is the darkest black known to man. And I know there's a synthetic one called Vantablack, which is like it's been created. So it's been used. There's a video you can find online of like someone has sprayed a basketball in this Vantablack substance. And it's just like watching a hole in the screen move about. It just does not reflect light at all. But I think from that, I think the natural equivalent was this discovery of ultra black fish, which are fish plural. So it's not just one type of fish, but they were discovered accidentally and they couldn't take a photo of them. It was just the shape of a fish. And I just was quite shocked by how quickly the conversation around this, the first and foremost discovery, which I've crossed out in the book, I don't read the word discovery, but it's in there, struck through, how quickly the kind of news of that encounter became about how can we extract from them this invisibility? How might it help the US military or something to... And I just found that so... It was such an eye-roll moment, but still such a disappointing moment, because of course that would be what would happen. But my question was always, how do they see each other? I just don't have the answer for that. I just don't have the answer for not what colour are they, but how do they find each other? Like, forget everybody else, forget us. How do they find each other? There was nothing in there about that, so I still don't know. But they are real.
They have their way, because they exist. So I'm really enjoying these questions. This lady here.
Thank you very much. A question for both of you. Do you feel a responsibility as poets to talk for all of us? I'm talking about the current climate in this country. And I think as poets, you've got privilege because people are going to listen to your words more than maybe some of us. I'm talking myself, I'm not a poet. But I'm so frustrated by what's happening in this country right now. But I feel as poets, people are going to listen to you.
What do you think?
I appreciate the hopefulness of that sentiment. But genuinely, I do think there's something important about taking language out of the context of political discourse, which I guess uses language like a utensil in order to prove a point or get across some kind of, to render the world in a kind of binary mode. And I think one of the things I love about poetry is it renders the world in a kind of polyvalent, various mode, which is really, I think, important in times like these, which are seeking for us to simplify things, to strike out nuance. And I think since poets are so interested in linguistic nuance, there's a power that we have, or that we can have. I don't think we have to, but I think the poets that I love and moved by do interrogate or interact with that role of the poet, at least a little bit, even in their more frivolous moments. I'm moved by the idea that it might be important to think about and through language in these ways.
Victoria,
did you want to speak
on that? I think it's scary, I think. I think there's a phrase in my head. Again, we're in a sort of churchy setting, and I think it's a biblical quote, you know, to whom much is given, much is asked. And what I mean by that is that I don't necessarily think it's a good thing to have power if you're not doing something useful with it. And I don't believe that poets are like these sort of sage-like beings. There have been fascist poets before. There are fascist poets. So ultimately, I think it's a question of, you know, that interrogation that I think you're speaking about in terms of, you know, poets being in a position to be listened to. We still have to be careful what we have to say. And I also think we are probably not always supposed to be popular. I think interrogating language is a pain in the neck to a lot of people. A lot of people might not want to hear it. Boris Johnson said something that really stuck out to me in his resignation speech, which wasn't much of a resignation, and he used this phrase at the end where he said, "Our brilliant and Darwinian system." And I just thought, what a strange and disturbing thing to say. And I think poets should unpack such phrases and really get to the finer threads of actually what that's about, which is, in my head, sounds a little bit eugenicist. But I think we're not always supposed to be popular. Especially in times which are not great, like now. So we sometimes have to be the pain in the neck, I think.
That's what makes poets so important. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for those wonderful questions. We have time now for both of you to read a final poem. Mm. You should go first.
I'd like it if we finished with you. I'll read this one, which is just a little, I always do like a little short poem towards the end, which is like a, I don't know.
a relative that people don't like. I really like short poems, like tiny poems. There's something about them. So this one's a blink and you'll miss it kind of a thing. So I give it a little bit more time. It's called Interior with Ceiling Fan. Wish that we could lie here for the rest of our lives. The blades of the fan above us whirling like a tangera's skirt. Everything outside this room, a distant country. Let me be this unguarded always, speaking without need of words, because breath is the oldest language any of us know.
We're in sync. I think I'm going to read something that has such a nice connection to that poem. Okay. Air. Friend, I saw you sitting at the window of your cell, high up in the loft, watching it all go on without you. I was ice and you were almost shadow. I waved like a child on a passing boat. Unsure of whether or not this counts, I want us to remember the unreadable air, how it waits to be recast by the touch of our lungs, our breath alone. A most humble poem, in, out, the couple we write, the couplet we write without thinking. Don't go. We must stay alive to our place in the family of green and breathing things that use even our sighs to make sweetness from light. What grace. Allow what is simple to be simple. Accept it as truth. Quiet as it's kept, we help the trees to breathe too.